Tony Hoy tried desperately to find mental health treatment for her son Daniel after he started having violent outbursts at the age of 10.
You could almost tell the stories that would describe him like a monster. At the same time, he's a little boy. He didn't want to be that way. He didn't like being that way.
But there weren't any real options. Treatment was unaffordable, and eventually she had to give up custody of her son just so he could get the care he needed. Today, the story of the shocking lengths some Americans have to go to just get the healthcare system to work for them, and what new state laws are also now in place to help them. Also, later this hour, recipes can be a way to remember our family, our friends, even our roots right here in Illinois. We're going to be speaking with food writer Nikki Davis about sweets that may not be trendy, but taste like classics. If you'd like to share your family dessert recipe, give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We hear a lot about how expensive healthcare in America is and how tough the system is to navigate. This can be particularly true if you're a parent of a child with a serious mental illness. That's because sometimes these children need a level of care that can't be provided at home. The problem is that 24/7 residential treatment can cost $150,000 a year. This is also something insurance companies often deny coverage for. New reporting from Side Effects Public Media shows that parents who can't afford that price tag may consider a workaround of last resort. That's giving up custody of their child, and if they do that, the state steps in, places the child in treatment, and pays for it. But of course, this decision to give up custody comes with a price of its own, and no one knows this better than Tony Hoy. She's a mother whose son Daniel has a severe mental illness. She lives in Rantoul, and she joins me now in our studio in Urbana to share her story. Tony, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
So I understand that you and your husband, Jim, adopted Daniel at age 2. What was he like as a child?
He was adorable. Just a beautiful, blue-eyed, blonde, chubby, sweet, funny, cuddly little boy. I fell in love with him the minute I saw him.
And when then did you first start to notice signs of mental illness?
Well, I think we were a little confused in the beginning. We didn't recognize it as mental illness. When children have been through a trauma background, when they've been bounced around in foster care, it's almost always very difficult to understand if the way they're behaving has to do with what they've been through before they came to you or if it's a manifestation of something else. So there's always a period of time, especially in the beginning.
And then they're also transitioning. So you
yes.
also don't know how much of this is just getting acclimated to a new permanent home.
New home, new siblings, new parents, new routine, and a routine that was very, very different from anything they'd had before. So when we started seeing behavior symptoms, we didn't necessarily attribute it to mental health situations. We thought maybe it was just that adjustment with adoption.
And also, I think when kids, especially boys, are anywhere between the ages of 9 and 10 and 11 and 12, if they're angry or they're trying to figure things out, sometimes we just think this is part of a process of kids growing up. Did you think that?
Not necessarily. In our situation, I had the benefit of being able to homeschool the kids. So for until he was in fifth grade, I was able to keep him at home. And I was able to keep him relatively stable during that time because I provided the structure. I was a very structured homeschooler, and so they ate at the same time every day and did school and had a very structured routine, which really helped him. It really benefited him. And we started to see some pretty serious symptoms when the economy crashed in 2008 and I had to go back to work full time. So that was the first time that all the kids went to public school for the first time. And what we learned later on was that the noise in the school, normal everyday noises that most kids are okay with, the noises in the hallway, the noises on the bus, were triggering PTSD symptoms and symptoms of that very traumatic time that he spent as an infant, where he was neglected and starved.
And how did those symptoms manifest?
In aggression, mostly. He would throw things. So this little boy who was always so sweet and so loving, he could be mean sometimes. He bullied other kids. He would try to start fights with them. He would throw heavy objects at them. He would threaten them under his breath. You would look at him sometimes and think, where did that come from? It was almost like it was two different people.
And how did you begin the process of trying to get help?
When he had a pretty severe aggressive incident, and we called the mental health department, and they admitted him to the psychiatric hospital. And it was one of the most scariest things that ever happened, because he was only 10. And so here he was, my baby, and having to put him in a really scary place like a psychiatric hospital. We were really frightened, and we didn't know what the future held. We didn't know how or if he could be stabilized, but we tried to keep hope, and we got along the rest of that year pretty well, but things kind of escalated from there, and then he was admitted to the psychiatric hospital 10 more times over the next 2 years.
Oh, wow. And then at what point, I guess that was the point that you realized he needed more intensive help.
Yes, and we were told that he needed more intensive help than what the local hospitals could provide, than what we could provide at home. We were told that he needed 24/7 residential treatment.
And is that when we started this conversation, I mentioned a price tag of $150,000 a year. Is that how much they said to you it would cost?
Yes.
And then what did your insurance company say?
They told us that it wasn't covered under their policy.
Oh, boy. So what did you think at that point?
Well, I looked for other options. So I called the school district and I applied for funding through the school district, which you can, but we were denied funding there. And then there was another program called the ICG at the time in Illinois, Individualized Care Grant. So I applied for that and we were turned down. I appealed, we were turned down. I called Medicaid because he received Medicaid as part of his adoption subsidy, and they also told us it wasn't covered.
And then at what point did you realize that the only way to help Daniel would be to give up custody to him to the state?
At the 11th hospitalization, where DCFS came to us and basically threatened us and said, you can't bring him home. It's not safe for your other children. And they threatened to charge us with child endangerment if we brought him home.
Because of your other children.
Because we had 3 other children at home. And they threatened to charge us with neglect if we left him at the hospital.
Mm. I can't imagine how tough that must have been.
Oh, it's still hard to even put into words. I think back on that and just remember the social workers telling us that those were our options. And we kept saying, but we can't be the only people in this situation. Like, what do other people do? But nobody was going to tell us what to do. We had to come to that decision on our own.
My guest is Toni Hoy. We're talking about her family story of how she had to give up custody of one of her children, Daniel, when he was 12 to help him get mental health treatment. I want to bring a couple other folks into this conversation to answer that question that Toni just posed about what other people do. Christine Herman's with us. She's a reporter with Illinois Public Media and Side Effects News, and she's been reporting on this issue. She brought Toni to us today. Hey, Christine, welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you, Nyla.
On the line with us from Chicago is Heather O'Donnell. She's a lawyer, and she's also the vice president of public policy and advocacy at a mental health facility called Thresholds. Hi, Heather. Thanks for being with us as well.
Thanks for having me.
Heather, as you're listening to Toni's, the story of Toni and her family and Daniel, it just seems like there's so many things that should have happened but didn't. And I know that there's the larger issue of our healthcare system being unaffordable for people, or maybe things that the state could have done to step in. Where do you see, first, I just wanted to ask you, how many people does this end up happening to in Illinois? How many families are in the same situation that Toni's family was in?
So this happens. Hundreds of families are confronted with this situation, unfortunately, every year. We've seen custody relinquishment of hundreds of kids over a several-year period. And this is, you know, custody relinquishment is a horrible, tragic situation that you're putting a child and a family in that never should have been put in this situation. And they get there because, as Tony alluded to, the right services aren't in place and are not covered by private insurance and are not paid for either through Medicaid or the state. A family should never have to go through 10 or 11 psychiatric hospitalizations of a child and then think about giving up their child to the state. The child becomes a ward of the state. The family is investigated for abuse and neglect when there was no abuse and neglect happening. And they do that only because the right treatment was not there. And there are many things that the state can do to prevent this from happening.
Well, like what kinds of things should be? You mentioned a couple of things that different, not just the state, but insurance companies. Heather, what do you think the most important things are that should be different?
So one of the things the state could do, there was actually legislation last legislative session that just ended in May that would require private insurance to cover treatment approaches for that are currently covered by the sector, team-based treatment models for children that have severe trauma and have behavioral health conditions related to that trauma, or they have bipolar disorder or schizophrenia or severe depression. It would require private insurance to cover these evidence-based approaches that the public sector has covered for decades, but that private insurance doesn't cover. And I think Tony talked about the fact that in-home care was not available to them, and that's because those types of models are not covered by private insurance plans. So that's one thing that the state could do, is pass that piece of legislation, which was Senate Bill 3213 and carried by Senator Melinda Bush. The other thing that they could do is the state needs to invest in a system of care for kids and adults with significant mental health conditions. We shouldn't have to wait until somebody has had multiple crises before the right treatment is available, and that we force families into a position where they have to consider abandoning a child at a hospital is so beyond the pale. We have a program, the Individual Care Grant Program, which is now called the Family Support Program. That is a funding mechanism that can pay for either residential care or home-based care or any kind of treatment approach that would help stabilize the child and the family and keep them together and connected. And we should not be waiting until the 11th hour to do this.
And Heather, that family support program, is that a state program?
It is a state program, and it is for kids and families that have private insurance coverage or Medicaid coverage. It is sort of a stopgap for families that don't, that have private insurance, where their insurance does not cover residential treatment or the treatment models that I was talking about. So it is available to people, but several years ago, due to budgetary constraints, prior to the current administration, the state severely restricted eligibility for that program. So the program sort of withered on the vine. And there was legislation that was passed a few years ago to revive that program and rehabilitate basically the program. But it is still suffering from nearly shutting down. So a lot of hospitals are not aware that this is still an option for families. Families aren't aware that it's still an option because it's a very difficult program to get into. And the state also, there was also a piece of legislation that passed this last session that is sitting on the governor's desk called the Early Mental Health and Addiction Treatment Act that would create treatment teams under the Medicaid program for young people, for adolescents and young adults who have severe trauma or significant mental health conditions, to help them in the early stages of their mental health condition. So one thing that the current governor could do is to sign that bill.
We're speaking with Heather O'Donnell. She's the Vice President of Public Policy and Advocacy at Thresholds, a mental health treatment facility in Chicago. And we've been talking to Toni Hoy about her family story as well. Christine, when part of this seems to also be I imagine in your reporting, you found that just finding information out about this probably is a full-time job and is really hard to do to just even also navigate the system.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one of the things that Toni does is she offers consulting services to families. The other family who I spoke to for my reporting, the way that he was able to avoid a lockout was he Googled lockout because this was something a well-meaning social worker told him he could look into as an option for helping his son get treatment. They were in the same situation. He came across Toni's blog and he reached out and she basically said, whatever you do, don't lock out your child, because she realized that there were different various consequences to actually going through this process. And then she helped him navigate. He says she was instrumental in helping him figure out who to call and how to appeal to the insurance company and request a waiver from the child welfare agency to try to get coverage, to try to find a place that would take his child, even though his insurance was denying coverage. And he figured out a way, but he said he wouldn't have been able to do it without having the tenacity to know how to find what resources were available and which people to contact. And he spent hours on the phone for days, for weeks, in order to get it worked out. But that's what he had to do to avoid the same type of situation.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with reporter Christine Herman, Toni Hoy, and Heather O'Donnell, talking about this particular issue of children with severe mental illnesses and how insurance companies should be helping treat them. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guests are Side Effects and Illinois Public Media reporter Christine Herman. She's producing actually a new podcast for Side Effects called The Workaround, and it's about how people have to deal with insurance and try to find a workaround. And in this case, we're learning a really difficult story that Toni Hoy was faced with, a difficult decision she was faced with, having to surrender custody of her son, Daniel, in order to have him be properly treated for mental illness. We're also talking to advocate Heather O'Donnell. She's the Vice President of Public Policy and Advocacy at Thresholds. They're a mental health treatment facility in Chicago. Christine, you mentioned something before the break about just this whole idea of lockout, which is what, Toni, you were told to do with your son, Daniel. And it's this idea that giving up custody of your child to the state to make sure they get care, and it's called a psychiatric lockout. How does this work?
So when a child is in the hospital and the hospital has done what they can to stabilize them, but isn't able to provide the next steps, levels of treatment that they need, they basically determine that the child is beyond medical necessity and they prepare them to be discharged. But if the parent is not willing or able to take the child home hasn't been able to get them a placement in a residential facility, which is where they really need to be, many of these children, then they can basically just decide to literally lock their child out. So it's called a lockout. They just refuse to pick them up. It's also described as planned abandonment, because the plan is then what happens, the hospital will call the Department of Children and Family Services, or DCFS, the child abuse hotline, and then the state agency will step in to take custody of the child. The reason that the parents will do this is because once the state takes custody, they're obligated to provide the care, to place the child in a treatment center and to pay for it. And, you know, like Toni explained earlier, when they've exhausted every other option, they find that this is like the workaround of last resort to help their child.
This is a workaround, Christine. There's actually a state law that was passed 3 years ago to stop this and try to help families. Why is this continuing to happen?
So Toni was instrumental in getting this law passed because she reached out to state lawmakers and informed them about this problem. So, yes, in 2015, the first of the year, a law went into effect to prevent this from happening. There were six state agencies that all work with children, families at some level, and they were told to work together to create a program or to do something to make sure that when families reach this point, they don't have to surrender custody in order to get their child access to treatment. So it was supposed to put an end to psychiatric lockouts. DCFS was also tasked with keeping track of how often this still continues to happen. And the data that I requested through the Freedom of Information Act from that agency basically found that since that law passed, there have been 265 children who have entered state custody through a psychiatric hospital. About 100 of them, they were deemed as being at no fault for not being able to provide this care for their child.
So it sounds like in this case, there were still 100 families that were in the situation that Toni's family was in, where it's not that they wanted to do this. They felt like they had no other choice.
Yeah.
What does DCFS say about this?
So I talked to the director, BJ Walker, and I asked her, you know, why is it that there's this law and this continues to happen? And this is what she said.
If law could fix problems, we'd have a different world. What the law does is open up enough space so that people can use resources and figure out how to line up against the problems that are coming in the door.
That's the director of DCFS, BJ Walker, speaking to reporter Christine Herman, who's in studio with me, talking about her reporting for a new podcast called The Workaround from Side Effects. Christine, I'm not quite sure I understand that answer, because what is Director Walker saying about what the law exists, how the law exists as it stands and how it's supposed to help?
So these agencies I mentioned, it was just last year, so 2 years after the deadline set in the law, that they launched a program to basically intervene. When a family's considering a lockout, they can be referred to this program and they would be provided with additional resources to be able to help their child. But the problem is that one of the requirements to participate in this program is you have to be willing to take the child home. But, you know, as we've learned, that's often not an option for many of these parents if the child's at danger to themselves or to others. So this is why, from my understanding, these lockouts continue to happen, because, I mean, even BJ Walker, she told me this program is not a silver bullet. These problems are complex and it's a complex situation.
Toni, when you listen to, as someone who lobbied to try to change the law so families wouldn't have to be put in the situation that your family was in, I wonder what your response is when you hear the DCFS director say that, or what your reaction is to all of this.
I just want to refer back to what Heather was saying about earlier treatment. If I look back at my own situation, my own family situation, most kids who are in foster care score pretty high on a test called ACEs, which is a test that evaluates their level of trauma. And so I think it's safe to say that most kids who come out of foster care and go to any other kind of placement are going to have some kind of a trauma history. And I really, what I would like to see is from day one, when a child comes into foster care and gets into a good living situation, regardless of what that is, treatment should start then. Parents should be trained on therapeutic parenting techniques. Heather was talking about in-home care earlier. If someone had trained us in therapeutic parenting, and if we'd had many hours of in-home care earlier on, we wouldn't have reached the level of crisis that we did. And when we started seeing hospitalizations, maybe even after that first one, if we could have gotten much more in-home care, we wouldn't have reached a lockout. I think he would have done well. He didn't want to be the way that he was, and he had a very supportive family. And with the right services in place, I think he would have done well. As it turned out, he went through 5 years of residential care and still improved significantly. But I think it could have been done a lot easier and a lot better and a lot cheaper for the state, frankly.
Heather, is the part of the problem that the state's response to this is they don't step in until there's a crisis to the proportions of what Tony's describing before help is given?
Yes, I think that is correct. And I think it's important to understand that DCFS is not going to be the answer ever for the kids that we are talking about. The kids that we are talking about here are not abused and neglected kids currently. They may have suffered abuse and neglect as children and have significant consequences from that that manifest as mental and behavioral health conditions. But these kids do not belong in the child welfare system. So what is happening is that the current mental health system is, in all honesty, not designed for prevention and early treatment. The intensive treatment models, whether it's a residential treatment program or if it is intensive team-based home treatment, those are only available when a child or an adult has advanced symptoms. So we treat mental health conditions when it is stage 4 cancer. We don't treat at stage 1. So in defense of Director Walker, she should never have to see these kids. That is tragic beyond words when that happens. It does so much harm to the child that is struggling with significant mental health conditions, and then you're just layering on top of all of that when the child is being interviewed by DCFS workers about whether or not the parents have abandoned them, abused or neglected them. That's not the case here at all.
Well, it's also, I imagine, re-traumatizing.
Correct.
And further complicating an already difficult situation.
Yeah.
Tony, can I ask you about the after effects? What happened after you lost custody of Daniel?
As Heather said, you know, we went into the wrong system. So we went into the juvenile justice system. And so our son, who came to us as a first-time foster child, became a second-time foster child because of the trauma that he went through from being a first-time foster child. And we were charged with neglect. That charge was later amended to no-fault dependency. Just the process of, you know, any kind of legal separation between you and your child is incredibly painful. My husband described it as gut-wrenching, and I don't know if gut-wrenching even covers it. I mean, it was just the most painful thing we've ever been through. We cried in court. And through that process, I mean, that's a process that's set up for neglect and abuse cases. And that's primarily what they see in the court system. And so they tend to treat pretty much every case that comes through there the same way. And
so you were treated like parents who had abused and neglected your child.
So they use the same language, the same process. We were looked at the same way. We were spoken to the same way. We had to have our home inspected every month by DCFS. They wanted to interview our other kids when they were minors. And things that they would normally do for a parent who is neglectful or abusive, we had to go through all of that. And unless our only way out of it was for him to actually get better, or ultimately we found another way out of the system.
How? What was that?
Prior to becoming a freelance writer, I was an insurance agent, and so I started studying the Medicaid law. And I was looking particularly at other states that had high numbers of relinquishments, and particularly those that didn't. And so when I looked at other states that didn't have a relinquishment problem, I found that Medicaid was paying for the children's treatment. I didn't understand why Illinois was not. And so I questioned that. As an insurance agent, I understood how to read policy, which is written just like the law. And I learned that his treatment actually was covered. And so we filed suit against the state in 2010 for his treatment.
Christine, earlier this year, the state of Illinois actually did settle a class action lawsuit on the issue of children's mental health. Does that also open up access to treatment at earlier stages?
It should. That's the idea. So, you know, just shortly after Tony sued, they were able to settle out of court and get the funding for Daniel's treatment and regain custody. And then right around that same time, a lawyer filed on behalf of all Medicaid-eligible children in the state of Illinois. Basically, the lawsuit alleges that Illinois illegally withholds medically necessary mental health services from from children. And in a settlement that was just finalized in January of this year, the state was told, you have 9 months to come up with a plan to address this so that children have access to in-home or community-based services for mental health and emotional disorders. So by October, there should be a plan that's being introduced with how they're going to address this problem and create services, make services available. But everyone who I've spoke to says this is going to take time. They have to completely build a mental health system, bring providers to areas where they're not currently available, all of these things to make sure that children in any part of the state that are on Medicaid are able to have access to these services like we've been talking about at the earlier stages.
Heather, do you have confidence that this will happen?
I definitely think it is a step in the right direction, but I also want to point out that this consent decree and this settlement is for kids who have Medicaid. Most kids have private insurance and they're covered on their parents' plan. So they are not impacted whatsoever by this consent decree, not one bit. So we still have a long way to go in requiring private insurance to cover the things that families need to stabilize their child. But for kids who have access to Medicaid and who will have coverage, I do think that this is a step in the right direction. But the missing link here is that this settlement is not going to grow psychiatry. It's not going to grow therapy. It's not going to grow team-based treatment models. The only way to do that is to pay an adequate reimbursement rate for those services, and that is not contemplated in this consent decree.
That's Advocate Heather O'Donnell with Thresholds in Chicago. Tony, so as Christine mentioned, you were able to sue the state and regain custody of Daniel 3 years later when he was 15. I just want to ask how he's doing today.
He's doing very well. He went through a lot of treatment. He would probably tell you that he learned a little something from every therapist that he had, from every residential treatment center that he was in. Ultimately, it really came down to wanting a better life for himself and being willing to work with a therapist. He is now 23. He lives nearby. He lives independently. And a lot of that was a response to the program at Thresholds that Heather is a part of, where he had a whole team of people working with him on helping him learn to live independently. So he does work and he does live independently and support himself. And he's been aggression-free for 5 years.
And Christine, you talked to Daniel, actually, for your reporting. Let's hear a little bit of what Daniel had to say.
You know, I think I always wanted to get better. And sometimes it's so hard to do it for yourself. It almost helps to know that, well, you know, I'm doing it for myself, but I'm also doing it for my family and for our relationship.
Tony, I think what Daniel was sharing shows what a difference it can make when children or young adults have access to treatment and their parents and their family structure. And as you're in touch with other families who are thought about this because they think they don't have any other alternative to give up custody for their child, I wonder, do you think that families who are able to go through this experience, can they make it through intact?
Situations are as unique as each family. And I think a lot more families can be successful when they have the right therapy, the right treatment, the right support system. Especially for families who have kids who are very detached, kids who have literally grown up in third world country orphanages, where parents have not had them long enough to work on attachment, and the problems are pretty severe. I think those are some of the most challenging cases. And I think it's just a very individual thing as far as where the children are, how receptive they are to treatment, how strong the family is, how supportive the siblings are, and the services that are available. Not just services, but the right kinds of services that can truly meet the child's mental health needs.
That's Tony Hoy. She's a Central Illinois mom who lives in Rantoul. As she mentioned, she's a writer. She's actually written a book about her family's story. It's called Second Time Foster Child. Tony, thanks for being here and for sharing this story.
Oh, you're welcome.
I want to thank Heather O'Donnell as well for being with us. She's a lawyer and a mental health advocate with Thresholds, a mental health treatment provider in Chicago. Thanks, Heather.
Thank you.
And we mentioned Christine Herman. This is a story that we're talking about as part of a new podcast that's just been launched called The Workaround. It's about the lengths people take to get health care. This episode dropped a few days ago. It's about the challenges that parents of children with mental illness face. We'll tweet out a link and we'll have it available at our website at 21stshow.org. Thanks, Christine, for being with us as well and bringing us a story.
Thank you, Nyla.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. There's always a new food trend, right? And with the way everyone blogs or Instagrams or posts them to Pinterest, it's sometimes easy to forget the classics. But those classic recipes can be a way to remember our family, our friends, and even our roots. That's what Nikki Davis believes. She writes the Taste column for the Southern newspaper and also has her own website called Rooted in Food. She teaches hospitality and tourism administration at Southern Illinois University. And she's on the line with us now from Carbondale to share some Illinois classic recipes. Hi, Nikki. Welcome to the 21st.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Thanks for being here. And for everyone who's listening, if you want to share your recipes, you're always welcome to join us. You can tweet them as well. Our handle is 21stshow. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. So, Nikki, in your recent column for The Taste, you wrote about forgotten desserts. And I saw right. And I think a lot of these recipes date from a time before there were even refrigeration options in the home kitchen. So I think when we think about how modern appliances have changed the way we cook, why did you want to bring these forgotten desserts back?
Oh, these are desserts that are from my childhood, and that raisin pie there is one that we had every holiday, every celebration, and it's one of my favorites. So, of course, these are going to be the ones that I want to see people cooking, but more importantly than that, I think it's just important for us to be in the kitchen and cooking from scratch when we can, and I think that's a skill that is kind of starting to go by the wayside a little bit. We don't spend a lot of time in the kitchen with our kids or our grandkids teaching them how to cook. So anything that we can do to bring that skill back to the family, I think is important.
Did you do that in your family?
Absolutely. I actually grew up at the knees of my grandma and my mom. All of my aunts were great cooks growing up, so I learned how to cook from them. That was my culinary school, and I learned recipes that had been passed down in my grandmother's German family for generations. And those are things that I try to teach my own daughter. She's 11, so we're just kind of now in that cooking phase and helping mom in the kitchen a little bit. But absolutely grew up cooking with every female in my family.
And how is how else was food part of your growing up in Southern Illinois? What, and obviously it sounds like it was something you all did together. Was this also something where you cooked for other people as well?
You know what? Food was a central part of pretty much every family gathering, every celebration, every holiday, church potlucks when I was growing up. You know, everybody shared recipes and we all, in fact, some of those recipes I would love to have now to cook and I don't. But, you know, beyond that, my parents owned a restaurant and my mom catered out of our home kitchen when I was real little. So that was, food was always around and I was always around it. My parents were foodies before being a foodie was popular. So even when we traveled, food and experiencing the food culture wherever we went was kind of a central part of that vacation. So I guess food's always been part of my life in various aspects, but the cooking is what I always come back to.
And your website's called Rooted in Food. I wanted to ask how far back your family's roots go in Southern Illinois.
My roots actually predate Illinois being a state. I'm sixth generation thereabouts. And my husband's the same way. His family settled here in the early 1800s, as did mine. We're both German primarily with a little Scottish and Irish mixed in, but you know, genealogy is a big part of my life as well. So we've managed to trace all of these histories back quite a ways. But my Scottish side settled near Pomona, Illinois, which is in the far south. It's a little bit more south than Carbondale. in 1815. And Caleb Lindsay was that ancestor, and he brought 14 children and several grandchildren with him. So I tease people sometimes that I can stand in the middle of Jackson County and throw a stone and hit somebody that I'm related to.
We're speaking with Nikki Davis. She writes, as we're talking about her blog, it's called Rooted in Food. She also writes a column for The Southern, and she teaches hospitality and food tourism at SIU in Carbondale. Nikki, how do you bring these ideas into the classroom when we're talking about tourism and hospitality? We've been talking about families and home cooks.
Sure. You know, it depends on the course, and we do teach a lot of food courses here, and we do teach a course that is specifically related to food culture, and that's a freshman level course, but open to anybody on campus who's interested. And that particular course, students get to experience culture and food aside from their own, but one of the projects that they get to do is kind of tracing their own heritage and exploring their own food culture. And that course started last year. It's relatively new, but it's been very well received. And it's something I think our students really are enjoying doing. Aside from that, we have a lot of students who are just interested in food media. We have students who write their own food blogs, do their own cooking videos, sometimes for YouTube, sometimes for things that we do in classes and in the program. We've also worked on outside programs. A few years ago, we had a project called Good Food Local that was actually funded by the Department of Ag. And we actually worked with specialty crop growers and took that produce and ran cooking classes all over Southern Illinois, trying to teach people how to cook with those specialty products. So food's kind of intermixed in a lot of things that we do in the program in different ways.
And I wonder especially when you're thinking about your students, I mentioned Pinterest or Instagram. Mm-hmm. I also, lots of people, I think, love to share these recipes where it's just a video of making something now, and they're just sharing the video of how to cook something. Do you feel like, do you think we're kind of forgetting about classic recipes, or do we think we're going back to those because they are kind of such solid, especially when we're talking about baking? I mean, I feel like there's just it's basically a base, a foundation of a kind of a couple of things that you modify.
Right. I think we go through trends and we see a lot of that. And we're certainly seeing that just in how we're presenting food photos and recipes and those kinds of things. I always want to have a recipe in front of me. I try not to just go off of the video that shows up on Facebook, let's say, but to actually find the actual recipe for that particular food. I think we're a culture, and I experience this. I'm a mom. I work full time. My husband works full time. When you have active kids, and certainly if you have more than one kid, we're busy. So I think we're always looking for shortcuts and things that help us make mealtime easier or faster. But taking time to get back to cooking Sunday pot roast, let's say, in the oven that takes 2 or 3 hours, if you can do that on occasion, there's some pride and satisfaction that goes along with serving that meal to your friends and family.
Mm-hmm. Let's go through some of the desserts that you mentioned as you're talking about things to make for people. One I'd never heard of was a recipe that you have. It's called funeral pie. Can you tell us a little bit more about this?
Funeral pie is a little bit from Amish and German heritage, kind of a mix there. And it's raisin pie. And it's something that I grew up with. And it was called funeral pie because it was kind of a go-to for like my grandma's generation and her mother and grandmother's generations, a food that you could prepare when family is grieving the loss of a loved one. And that tradition of taking food to the family to help them kind of get through the initial stages of that grief and that loss. That's something that I don't think we see a lot of. We see it in small communities. We see it within families and close-knit friends. But we don't see that tradition happening community-wide anymore like it used to. So hence the name funeral pie. But it's really just a traditional raisin pie.
And so by raisin pie, Nikki, is that kind of like a mincemeat pie, in other words?
It's similar, but certainly I a little bit sweeter, or at least mine is a little bit sweeter than mincemeat, but it's literally raisins and sugar, and I put brandy in mine. Not everybody does, but I think that gives a little bit, kind of lifts the flavor profile a bit, and some lemon juice and butter, and that is all it is. And it's simple to do, but it's one that I think we don't think about making. And probably people, you know, our millennials and our Gen Xers around us probably have never had either. Certainly something that I still find on restaurant menus here locally in Southern Illinois, but it's typically that diner that's owned by, you know, somebody local. It's not something that we find on chain restaurant menus by any means.
Mm-hmm. You also highlighted pumpkin butter oatmeal bars. This is not your typical granola bar recipe.
No, that's more like a cookie cake bar, and they're it's it, the consistency is kind of a cross between a kind of a standard cookie and a cake. But cookies and cookie bars were something that my mom and my grandma baked when I was growing up. And in fact, my mom just brought me a bunch of cookie bars the other day, and they didn't last very long in my house. But my grandma would always bake either cookies or the cookie bars right as school was getting out. So when I would spend days at her house after school waiting on mom and dad to get off work, that's the memory and the smell. You know, walking in the back door, you smell those cookies baking, and you know you've got a treat waiting for you when you get home from school. That's where that kind of originates from. And the recipe that I shared is just one of many that are out there and available, but it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, the smell of baking is the one major reason why I love to bake. I wanted to ask you also about seasonal recipes. And I'm thinking this is a great time of year for summer fruit baking. I haven't had a chance. My sister
Absolutely.
Just brought me some blueberries from Michigan. I haven't had a chance to get there myself and get cherries because I have a great. I want to ask you about buckles, which I feel like is a good Midwestern summer fruit recipe. Are there others that you think is a great baking dessert for this time of year?
Here we have right now peaches. We're kind of in peach season. We're headed into apples. We start the summer, you know, late spring and summer with strawberries and kind of move through almost religiously by calendar, you know, by the month, what we can expect as far as fruit. Here we do a lot of crisps and crumbles,
mm-hmm.
Both of which are certainly very simple. We also do what we call dump cakes or dump recipes.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of like a buckle, I feel like, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it is. So different terms, different names probably in different parts of the country. But those are the two or three that are pretty popular here. We also, when apple season hits, apple pie, of course. Fritters. I mean, there's all sorts of things, lots of fried things here in the southern part of the state too.
Right. And well, it's an interesting thing when you think about, even if you don't use the term, because I feel like buckle, maybe that's a central northern Illinois, and then the further north you get to Midwest term, you don't use that term.
No, we don't. We're dump cake, cobbler, and crisps. Mm-hmm. What we use here, mm-hmm. and that's probably more southern. You know, we're a lot of the people who migrated and settled here came from what we call the upland south. They came through the Carolinas and up through Tennessee and Kentucky. So a lot of that southern food influence came with them, and we still have that here today strongly.
We are almost out of time, but since you mentioned that, I do want to mention, since you mentioned the South, you have a fried donut. It's basically fried biscuit dough. Is that also a popular family recipe that you had?
You know what, when I was a kid and a teenager, that I thought that was something that my mom made up because we got hungry one night for donuts.
I always thought it was something my mom made up too.
Well, I have found that to be the case. So when I met my best friend in high school, she started talking about her mom's biscuit donuts. I'm like, wait, my mom does those. And come to find out that it was kind of the go-to budget-friendly, quick and easy dessert for a lot of moms. And it's still one of my favorites. And it's a 50-cent can of biscuits, and you cut them in half, and you fry them and coat them in cinnamon sugar. And it's that simple.
It is that simple.
So good.
And it's a good reminder for how simple and easy it is for us if we want to do some of these classic recipes. I want to thank Nikki Davis for being with us. We will tweet out Nikki's article and blog for The Southern. Her blog is called Rooted in Food. She also teaches at SIU. Nikki, thanks for being with me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
That does it for us today. It's back to school week on the 21st. And later this week, tune in starting tomorrow, we're going to be talking about the first ever statewide assessment of how Illinois kindergartens are doing. Later in the week, we're going to be talking about a new state law that requires all school systems to have a system in place to identify and teach gifted students. And we're going to be convening a panel of teachers who are going to be giving parents advice and information about what they need to know as the school year starts. You can always head to our website, 21stshow.org. That's got all of the information for our social media, for our Twitter handle, for our Facebook page. If you want to leave us a voicemail or send us an email or find past shows, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.